Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fucking up and down this fucking street. I gotta find a fucking place where the fuck hits me.
It's funny, you know, I did a chat with JJ French from Twisted Sister a couple of days ago, and we...
There we go.
Hey, you got the background going on as well. I love it.
Fancy. Yeah, we're professional.
Tap. Yeah, I did this chat with JJ French from Twisted Sister. We spoke for about 90 minutes. We had an amazing conversation. His camera was off the whole time, and I just presumed it's because he wanted it off. And we get to the end, and he's like, oh, fuck, man. I didn't mean to have the camera off. And he turned it on
bummer.
Minutes before we said goodbye. Cheers, dude. Good to see you.
Yeah, right on. You too.
How have you been finding
life? I don't have a drink in my hand yet.
Yeah, well, there's always time.
Yeah, it's happy hour someplace, right?
It's happy hour in the UK, 9 p.m.
Oh, yeah, it's way past happy hour. Where in the UK are you?
I'm Birmingham-based. I was born and raised here. I saw you guys. I'm trying to remember the name of the venue. I saw you guys in a few years back. I did a chat with Buzz from Metal Hammer on the roof. There was like a roof on the venue. You remember the club?
I'm trying to think of which.
I want to say the Rainbow, maybe. It wasn't like one of the academies or anything like that. It was quite kind of like industrial, minimal kind of space. My friend Thomas, who plays in a band called Goddamn, was opening up for you. I think he did like a little DJ set. And I think it was when you'd done the Bass Is Loaded record. It was on that tour.
Right. So we had two bass players then, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to think of where that one was.
I should know. I'll have to look.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I was born and raised here. I moved to London, where, you know, obviously many people go for this industry. But then last summer, because of everything that's been going on, I just had to pack up my things and move back home because I'm a DJ by trade. And obviously, you know the score.
Yeah,
there ain't been any shows in a while.
Yeah, it sucks.
Do you know what, though? I have thoroughly, although there's been serious lows and there's been financial strains and, there's been hurdles and troubles and obstacles for sure. I currently am in one of the best mental places I think I've ever been because I've had the time to, like, you know, take stock of life and think about what's important.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know if you've been up to any of that soul searching and self-reflection, and because we've had a lot of time on our hands, haven't we?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely miss playing shows and all that, but then at the same time, you know, I get to spend all the time with my family, so, you know, that's the plus. I have two kids.
So how old are they
now? They're constantly home because they, you know, they're doing school. They're in school right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Math class.
Yeah.
How old are your kids now?
12 and 15.
Wow. So teenage age.
Yep. Yeah.
You got your hands full then.
Hard, man. Yeah. It's funny because, our daughter, she's the teenager and she'll just kind of sit in a room all day with the lights off, you know, and we're kind of felt a little worried. And it's like, oh no, wait a minute, that's exactly what we did as teenagers too.
Yeah.
So turn that music down.
Yeah. No, I literally have to tell her that, because she's got, you know, nowadays the kids have headphones and she can't hear a damn thing I'm saying. I'm like, hey, do you want to be like me going, huh, all the time? Give your ears a break.
How are your ears after, you know, pummeling it for as long as you've been doing it? Are they all right? Are they intact?
They're still there, but they're pretty shot. I say, huh, a lot, you know.
come again?
What? Yeah.
I've noticed you've got your record cover behind you. And so for me, one of the best things about doing this show, beyond just getting to speak to, you know, interesting and creative people like yourself, is because I'm obsessed with the research side of these conversations. I like to be immersed and prepared for the conversation. So for me, the best thing about doing this show is getting to dive deep into the back catalogs of whoever it may be, whether they're comedians or filmmakers or musicians. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know about your first solo record. So not only did I check out the new one, but I went back and listened to the Fickle Finger record. And
oh, cool.
Hillbilly Maths. Is that the name of the track on that?
Oh, yeah. Right.
That's my jam right there. An amazing record. And then this new one, the fucking, is it Shark Overdrive? Shark Overbite?
Shark Like Overbite.
Yeah.
The kind of poppy sounding one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, both the records have the experimental end, you know, that obviously people are familiar with the projects you've played in over the years. But then there is some really just like hooky alternative rock bangers on there, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I don't know. I do both things and just figured that, you know, why can't I just combine them?
Yeah.
You know,
do you write all the lyrics as well?
Yes, I did. So from what I remember.
A man of many talents, man.
I really
enjoyed both of them. It was a new exposure to me. I've obviously been, you know, familiar with your work in Melvin's for years, but
this
first time I delve in and you know, checked out the solo stuff. So how long have you been writing songs? Have you been writing in the Melvin's since like day one? Have you always had a little bit of a hand in that?
Barely. You know, Buzz is the main songwriter, and I mean, he's got so many songs always that you know, I easy for me to just concentrate on the drums. That's a job, big job in itself.
And
Buzz is a great songwriter, so, but occasionally it'll happen. The bit was co-written. There's a few that I've written myself, and then there's actually a couple songs very rare that we co-write songs together, at least, like, you know, me playing guitar or showing Buzz something on guitar, you know. But the bit was my song, and then he arranged it and wrote lyrics. And then there's also a new Melvin's record out,
Which is also amazing. I'm a huge doo-wop Frank Zappa when he does the doo-wop. Obviously, I love the Beach Boys, because who doesn't? And
yeah, right.
I love it when you guys, again, mix that sort of bubblegum pop element with obviously your unique sense of humor, with the low ends, you know, Melvin's rumble. An amazing album, an amazing record.
Thanks.
Like classic Melvin's. Do you enjoy playing bass as much as playing drums? Do you enjoy it more? Is it the same?
It's different, I guess. I mean, you know, I know it's not my forte, but, you know, it's you know, basically just having some fun, really.
Because you're on bass on this new record, right?
You're
on bass on the, is it Trez? What was the last one the three of you did, the 83 lineup? It was a couple of records ago.
Trez Cabrones.
That's the one.
Is what it was called.
So that was the first time you three kind of reconnected and recorded, was it?
Sort of, yeah, pretty much. I mean, how that whole thing came about was... Jello Biafra was having his 50th birthday party, and he had also his label Alternative Tentacles had released vinyl versions of the early Melvin's demos with Mike Dillard on drums and Matt Lucan playing bass. And you know, Matt probably wouldn't be playing with the band anymore, but Mike has been a friend for a long time. And so we got back together with him and me on bass, and did those shows. And when we were rehearsing for those shows, we were just kind of, I think Buzz was just like sort of half jokingly saying, oh, we should just write new songs with this lineup, you know, ha ha ha. And then we ended up doing it.
Well, one thing I've noticed from the outside looking in with the Melvins is I imagine you're the kind of band, tell me whether or not I'm right or wrong, whoever you jam with, if you just invite someone over for an afternoon to play some songs just to mess around, it seems like there's a record that always comes out of those like jam sessions every time. There's a new lineup, there's a new version of the band, there's a new album. Like, just the prolific productivity of the band has always been inspiring to me.
Yeah, well, that is how some of that stuff happened too, you know. I think even us playing with Steve McDonald now was kind of like, oh, want to come over and jam? And then, oh, let's record some songs, you know. And, but then we've also purposely done stuff like, you know, invited bands that we like to come and try to make music with us, you know. I guess, well, it's been a year now, but about a year ago, we had the guys from Mudhoney come down to Los Angeles and write some songs and record with us and play a few covers as well. And that, yeah, we were hoping to do more of that, but you know, since the pandemic happened, we haven't been able to do it. But there's an EP that came out of that stuff. It's pretty cool.
That's like a lot of history right there as well.
New Melvins record. I know.
I mean, so
it was fun. I mean, and funny enough, it sounded just like the Melvins and Mudhoney playing together.
Yeah, well, what was the year? Did you start Melvins in 83? Was that when the band first formed?
Yes, that's when the band formed. I obviously the second drummer, but I did see them in 83 for the first time. So I kind of know, you know, I know the story, you know. And yeah, with Mike Dillard, it's like whenever we hang out with them, you know, it's like one of those guys where, you know, there might be a year or two that goes by when you haven't seen him, but then once you get back together, it's like nothing's really, you know, nothing's changed, no time's gone by at all. You pick up right where you left off, you know.
I think all the best friendships are like that.
Yeah, and I mean, just even hanging out with him, it's like, yeah, it just feels like same sense of humor, you know. He's definitely a Melvin, that's for sure.
He's a lifer.
Yeah.
How did you
We forced him into it. You know?
How did you first meet Buzz? And what was your first impression of Buzz? I love Buzz. I've had him on the show. He's one of my favorite people. He's amazing.
Yeah. Cool. Our first meeting, well, I mean, I don't even know if we really met, but I've told this story a bunch, but the first time I saw the Melvins was on this radio show. Local radio show. The radio station was doing this live show from the Elks Hall in Aberdeen, Washington, and it was a benefit radio show, and anybody could come down and perform. And so I was at the time playing in my high school cover band, and we decided it would be fun to go down there and play on the radio. You know, we had nothing going on. It was around Christmas time, so it was like a, you know, like a benefit show or whatever. And when we get there, there's this band playing, and we didn't know who they were. The area that we came from is pretty small, so we kind of knew everybody in every band. These guys were from 10 miles away in Montesano, Washington. And anyway, you know, I was really into like heavy metal stuff at the time, more like new wave of British heavy metal stuff, like Motorhead and, you know, Iron Maiden. So, and I'd never really seen a punk rock band before, but I could tell these guys were a punk rock band. But to me, that's what, you know, that's what they sounded like. It was like Motorhead versus mixed with the Ramones. And they would play really short songs at really fast and not stop in between. And the radio broadcaster would try to get a couple words in, and then they'd just start the next song and blast through it. And, you know, we were just like blown away, you know.
What is this, like, what? Kind of thing? Yeah.
Yeah, right, you know. I don't know how much my bandmates really dug it, because they weren't into the same stuff as me, but I could tell there was something there. And then I saw him play again. We kind of talked to him a little bit out, you know, like as we're about to play or whatever. Oh, and what we didn't realize is that they showed up before us and realized that there wasn't a PA system there, and they went back home and got theirs and brought it. So amazing. When my band got up to perform. All we had was the radio broadcast mic for our singer to sing in, and he couldn't hear a thing, and he was just wailing into the microphone. Oh, it sounded horrible. And then I saw them about 4 months later opening up for this other band from Aberdeen called Metal Church. I don't know if you're aware of who those guys are.
Yeah. I'm kind of immersed in the Seattle history at the moment because I'm reading a book by Barrett Martin, who I presume you know and go back.
Oh, from Screaming Trees?
Yeah. So he's got two books out. I didn't know. Part of the research for the podcasting, which I love. He's got two books out about traveling the world and learning different percussive techniques different approaches to playing the drums from Africa to Asia to Australia. And he obviously begins the story in Seattle. So that's kind of where the story begins. And so that's exactly where my headspace has been for the last couple of days is right there in that time. So, yeah.
Right.
So you come across the Metal Church guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So they played it. They played opening for those guys. And then, part of the story is Chris Novoselic from Nirvana. He went to my high school, and he had told me that he had joined the Melvins. And I was like, oh, really? And so he was going to be playing at this show, which he did. He only came out and played one song at the very end of their set.
Right.
So I don't know if he joined them on stage, but he presented it to me more like he was joining the band.
They really have had a lot of bass players over the years, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, he was a guitar player, actually.
Right, back right, then. Right.
You know, he got forced over to bass. but anyway, you know, and I remember talking to them a little bit at a party after that show, but it was maybe a couple months after that that Novoselic brought the two guys over to my house, Buzz and Matt, and they were telling me that they were looking for a drummer. And they'd see me play, obviously, with my other band, and
just your covers, just the covers band you're in.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
You must have been good then, if they were like, he's doing covers, but he's good.
Right. I think they'd also seen us play at like some kind of high school dance or whatever.
Right.
And you know, I think Buzz now says like, yeah, I remember thinking like, yeah, no, I don't like the band that much, but the drummer's good. You know. I used to wear glasses too, and like when I played, like I my glasses would slip down on my nose, so I'd be doing this all the time. Got really good at that, and I think that's kind of how I got the gig.
That's the kind of guy we need.
That guy could really multitask.
That dexterity right there.
Right. Yeah.
So Aberdeen, was it a tiny, tiny place? Was it like a village?
Yeah, pretty much. 18,000 people. You know, it was a city, but
it was a city.
It was a city, but it was not that big of a city, and there was nothing going on there. It was a logging town, and the logging industry had pretty much dried up in the 70s there. So there was a lot of nothing going on. You know, and there wasn't really places for us to play. You know, that one gig or one or two gigs, that was really it. Nothing happened around there. There was nobody trying to like put on shows or anything like that. But I mean, to me, it didn't matter because, joining the band, I knew that those guys were already playing, like in going up to Seattle and playing gigs or Olympia, which is, you know, the capital of Washington.
Yeah.
So it was like, that was more appealing than trying to play any kind of hometown gig anyway. You know,
it's super interesting. In Barrett's book, he kind of speculates as to why all those bands came out of that area at that time. And I'd love to get your take, but his sort of reasoning and rationale was, part of it was the weather, and it was always cold. It was always wet. So people spent a lot of time hunkered down indoors, jamming, rehearsing. And then the other thing he said was, as you mentioned, the kind of the economic environment and how little work there was and how little, you know, kind of industry was going on. So a lot of people were very blue collar, and the music reflected that. You know, obviously you've got LA was kind of had the hippie more, yeah, chill bro kind of vibe going on. New York, you've got that kind of hipster art school that you said. Places like Detroit, Seattle, it's more blue collar, almost bar band, but like really good bar bands.
Yeah, I'd say that's exactly right. You know, the weather is a big one. And I mean, well, there was stuff going on in Seattle and Olympia, but in Aberdeen, there was nothing. So that is literally all we did was practice. You know, I was 17 in high school, and I'd get home from school and those guys would be there waiting for me every day, you know. Didn't even matter if we had gigs. Like, I mean, we might have a gig like a couple months down the road, but we would just like constantly play and try to get better and constantly write new songs and just, you know, yeah. Otherwise we'd just be out causing trouble, being up to no good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was our way to escape, you know, it was our way out of there.
Was that always on the cards for, I mean, from the Melvin's point of view with Buzz steering the ship, was he somebody that was driven to get out and music was the way, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised it took as long as it did, you know, I'm surprised that thinking about it now that he would even stick around there, because, you know, he was, by the time I joined the band, he and Matt were already 20. And could easily get out of the house, you know, leave and go do whatever. But it didn't.
How old were you, Dale?
16, 17.
Right.
I was 16, going on 17 when I joined the band. So,
as the song says.
So, I guess I never thought about this, but maybe it was because of me that they stuck around. And then eventually, you know, yeah, eventually things did kind of fall apart with working with our bass player. And Buzz ended up moving to San Francisco. And I was like, I'll go. I got, you know, let's continue this band or let's start something else or whatever. Let's continue playing music. So
you followed him out there, did you? Or down there?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yep. And then we basically started all over again.
It's interesting because obviously at that point in time, I guess, was when Seattle was becoming that musical cultural hotspot that the world then discovered.
It wasn't like, well, in Seattle during the mid 80s, there was a lack of shows especially a lack of all ages shows because there was some trouble with a teen nightclub. I can't remember exactly what it was. It was like drugs or somebody got, you know, stabbed or something like that happened. That was bad. And so the city of Seattle banned all teen dance clubs or any all ages shows. So there was a great venue that we used to play all the time called the Gorilla Gardens. And that pretty much got killed because of that. So that moved a lot of bands into bars, but I wasn't old enough to be in a bar, you know? So the deal was, is that you had to play and you couldn't be in the bar unless you were playing. And then you had to get out immediately, you know? So there a lot of shows got moved down to Tacoma, Washington. There was a couple places down there that were big, but about 1988, which is when we left, you know, there just wasn't much, you know. I mean, we were still playing shows and, you know, maybe making $100. So it wasn't like we were leaving something that we thought was going to be some lucrative deal. And yeah, we'd already been down to San Francisco making our first record and liked it and thought that would be cool. Even us moving away, it didn't seem to matter because people still consider us a Northwest band.
Yeah.
Even now, I mean, you know, we've been here for 30 years, you know, in California.
Since the '90s, right?
Eighties, you know, since 88 is when I moved to San Francisco. And, but yeah, doesn't seem to matter. So now we basically have three hometowns, almost four, you know, it's like Seattle and San Francisco. And the Los Angeles, and then also Portland kind of claims this because, you know, we're close enough.
Nice. Well, hometown shows are cool as well. There's a special quality in the air whenever you play a hometown show. I found that from Birmingham.
Yeah.
Whenever the tour rolls through town and I'm DJing with bands, I'm like, yeah, I actually got to play in Birmingham on the 50th anniversary of the debut Black Sabbath record, opening up for opening up for Zach Sabbath, which is Zach Wilde, Joey Castillo on drums and Blasco on bass doing Sabbath songs. And it was, it was 50 years to the day since the record came out in the home of Sabbath, my hometown. That was a special night. And I was like, it's good to be from Birmingham for once.
Oh, yeah. No, you guys have great bands, you know, Zeppelin and then Judas Priest, man.
Hell yeah.
My favorite.
And Diamond Head. Right there,
Judas Priest.
Have you read Rob Halford? Diamond Head, Stourbridge, which is where Robert Plant's from.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, did you see? You're just going to mention something about Halford's book.
So good.
Were you?
So
yeah,
it's
I got it. I'm in the middle of reading it
right now.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
I won't say anything other than it is. It's powerful stuff. I had him on the show, and he's just,
awesome.
I'm presuming you go back with him and you've had interactions with him, but he's just the loveliest, sweetest, most down-to-earth dude. He's amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I haven't met him. Buzz talked to him on the phone not that long ago. He actually got to interview him about the book.
Amazing.
And so that was cool. But, we've always said that Unleashed in the East is the best heavy metal record ever, you know? My favorite, it's hard to leave out Sabbath, of course, but just that one for me, it was the right time, right? I remember the first time hearing Judas Priest, growing up like a Kiss fan, that was like the obvious like next step was like Judas Priest, heavier, scarier, and I still love that record.
I've noticed.
Oh, and Napalm Death, of course, they're from there.
Well, so Barney's a friend of mine, Barney Greenway, and the other day I just spoke to Mick Harris, the drummer on Scum, and I guess what people consider the godfather of the blast beat style. Local heroes, Napalm Death, are real hometown heroes in Birmingham, and they all still live around here, which is rare because most people get out.
Right.
Aussie's obviously long gone. I think Rob Halford still comes and stays in Warsaw from time to time, but he's obviously in Arizona for most of the time. Right. Tony Iommi still lives around here. He used to frequent the pub that I used to work at as a kid. So I'd be waiting the tables and I'd see Tony Iommi would be there with his family having dinner. I'd be like, fucking so cool.
Wow.
I noticed there, awesome. Dale, you've got Gene Simmons on your shirt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a take on what's then the black metal band. I'm blanking on their name right now. I'm gonna get killed by the black metal community here for forgetting their names.
Mayhem, Emperor.
Recognize that? If I could cover it.
I'm not a massive black metal aficionado.
It's right on the tip of my tongue, and I can't think of it.
I just had Jonas Ackland on the show, actually,
and it was a take on that.
I just had Jonas Ackland on the show. He directed that Lords of Chaos movie, which is about the whole Swedish black metal.
Oh, okay.
Scene.
Okay, right. Gotcha.
He'd know.
Nice.
But for me, let's talk about Gene Simmons.
I'm going to remember it when we hang up.
Let's talk about Gene Simmons because tell me what you think of this analogy. Buzz and Gene, on paper, very perhaps different individuals. One represents truly alternative culture. The other perhaps is Mr. Corporate Commercial Rock. But I see a lot of similarities with those two from the little times I've spent with them both, in similar kind of sense of humor, both very unashamedly themselves, outspoken, opinionated, but just like the best dudes. I love them both, and I think they get sometimes a bit of a bad rep in the press because they just speak their mind and a lot of people don't like that. I love Gene. Right. I think he's absolutely amazing.
Gene's been nothing but nice to us, ever since we met him. I met him actually at a record signing, but we'd already kind of been in contact because we were sort of asked to do a song for their Kiss My Ass tribute record.
Yep. Is that how Going Blind came about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we'd always covered that song and ever since I joined the Melvins, like we always still like Kiss, even though at the time it was like, completely unhip to fly the Kiss flag. We were, bands like Red Cross were, and somehow I think those guys kind of became aware of that, we grew up with you guys and we love that. And I think that, I know that when we were on Atlantic Records, we had a product manager that worked for us and she used to be their publicist.
Right.
And she made those guys aware of us doing like the solo records with the copycat Kiss covers. And so they knew that. And so anyway, I met Gene at this record signing, and when I met him, I handed him a tape of us doing Going Blind, and told him who I was. And he's like, oh, and he gets up out of his chair and shakes my hands. And he's like, tells the other guys in the band, hey, this is the drummer from the Melvins. And he just gave me a tape of Going Blind. And, you know, it was just like, you know, totally, totally nice. And, you know, we didn't get picked for it. You know, he actually called me and left. I'm bummed I didn't answer the phone. But I had this voice message from Gene, and I was like, hey, this is Gene Simmons from Kiss. And just wanted to let you know that I listened to your version of Going Blind. I thought something was wrong with the tape at first because it was really slow, you know. But, you know, I just want to let you know we've gotten all these submissions for this. I'm not sure if it's going to get picked or not, but I just wanted to say how much we really appreciated it. And you know, that was it. And so I think maybe one of us said something in the press about like, oh, they didn't really like our track, you know, well, whatever. And then, of course, he heard that and called up. He's like, you know, that's really not the case. You know, I see that you guys are playing in town pretty soon with Primus. And how about if I come down and play with you guys and we'll play? Want to play Going Blind live? We're like, sure. So he came down. And that was awesome. You know, he brought his bass down and he had a roadie take care of his bass and we opened up the case and there was like a big giant pack of Kiss guitar picks in there.
Awesome.
And so we hung him up on the mic stand before he came out, you know. And what happened is his bass got locked in the dressing room and nobody had the key. And we're sitting on stage waiting for him to come out. I'm like, the fuck is he? You know, because he's like, you know, you don't have to make some big announcement about me coming out. I'll just walk out there and we'll just do it, you know? And so we're waiting for him. Little did we know that he's like, they're telling him to like kick the door into the dressing room. If you go on YouTube, you can find, you know, if you look for Kiss, Gene Simmons plays with the Melvins, you might see where he's like trying to kick the door to the dressing room in.
Incredible.
So anyway, yeah. See, he comes out there finally. He goes up to the mic stand and he looks at the guitar picks and he's like, whose are these? I'm like, your name's on them? They're yours? Oh, grabs them and starts throwing them out in the audience, you know?
He's so great.
You know, and then from there, we got to open up for Kiss when they did their reunion tour, their first time putting the makeup back on.
Oh, wow.
So, and
that must again, have been a cool run.
Even on that tour. Yeah, Gene would come into our dressing room dressed in full makeup, ready to go on stage. How are they treating you in here? Oh, looks like they're treating you like kings. Yeah. I even saw Gene not that long ago, and, you know, he's always been nice. Oh, and he did an interview for the Melvins documentary.
Wow.
And all the stuff that he said about us, I felt was right on. And, I mean, he understands what's going on. He's not a dumb guy. People always give him shit. There's something I saw recently. Where he was talking about, and it was one of somebody like that was putting a headline out there to kind of like, you know, what do you call that? Bait. Right. And so it was like, Gene Simmons says that Rolling Stones guitar player is a better bass player. You know, it's like, actually what he was talking about, Ron Wood playing bass on the Jeff Beck records, and his bass playing is fucking awesome. And Gene was really into his bass player. That's why he says that, you know? Or something about how he also thought that they were like, you know, in a way better than Led Zeppelin. And it's like, well, if you know about the Jeff Beck group and where they came from, Zeppelin totally copied those guys, you know? Down to the singer, down to even the songs that they were playing, you know? Zeppelin started playing some of the same songs Jeff Beck were already doing live.
He knows his music history, doesn't he, Gene? He's a student of music, and he's not, totally, as you say, as clueless as people think that he is. I think he just puts up that character because he's a bit of a comedian, and he's on the wind up a lot, and totally. I love that about him. If you connect with him on that level, totally, then there's all kinds of fun to be had.
Yeah,
but he's the real deal. He's sincere, isn't he?
I know. Exactly. You know, and I think probably still a big music fan as well.
Big time. Yeah, loves the Beatles.
But yeah, it's easy. I guess it's easy to it's easy to get on those guys, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, we spent we've listened to their books on tape on tour, both his and Paul's. They're pretty funny.
With them
highly
reading.
Entertaining.
With them reading.
Yes.
Amazing. I've got to hear that.
Yeah.
What was Chris Novoselic's deal, Dale? Was he a similar kind of driven figure like Buzz? You're saying he was kind of instrumental in getting you in the Melvins. Was he somebody on the scene that was driven to create and get out of there and do it?
I'm not sure. I mean, those guys knew him from he was like the big weird guy working at Taco Bell that they met.
He is tall, you know, isn't he?
That
he's massive.
Interest in music or whatever. Yeah, right. He was kind of, I mean, he was like a really funny guy. He was kind of the class clown in school, I guess you'd say.
Were you in the same year or just the same?
No, he was a couple of years older than me. But how I knew him to begin with is he had a brother that was in the same grade as me. And so that's how I knew him. And then eventually met him in high school. We're in the same school, though he was older. But, you know, he played music and stuff like that, but it wasn't until I think, you know, Cobain started playing music and was looking for people to play with. You know, I know that there's this museum in Seattle called the Mopop Museum, and they have it's like a Seattle music history museum sort of, and there's like a big Nirvana exhibit in there, and there's actually a letter that Buzz had written to Chris. Had moved away for a while to Arizona. I cannot remember why he would move away to Arizona. But anyway, in this letter, Buzz says to him something about Kurt having these songs and them being pretty good, and that he was looking for people to play with. So he heard the tape and then started playing with them in. Yeah.
And I guess you witnessed that band from the ground up evolve. And weren't you in Nirvana in the early years as well? Did you do the demos with them?
Well, the tape that he's talking about is one that I went and recorded with him at his aunt's house on her four-track reel-to-reel. So, yeah, I was involved in that and also playing on their very first demo.
Was that produced by Jack?
Yes. Yeah, and the songs ended up on, some of them on Bleach. And the majority of them on Incesticide, and then the rest of them on the box set.
Barrett talks a lot in his book about Jack Endino. Is that how you pronounce his surname?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he says he was really like the guy who was so instrumental in shaping that, if you want to call it, Seattle sound. What was he like to work with as a, you know, producer and an engineer? Was he a creative, hands-on, switched on, good dude to work with?
That stuff that we did was so quick, you know, like the demo I did with them, we recorded in like 6 hours. So it was just like, get in there and go.
Yeah. But
you know, I think that we already knew, I mean, I already knew him. Cobain is the one that booked the session, and he had called up, I think he called up Reciprocal Studios probably because, Soundgarden had already recorded there. Their first EP was out and was kind of, you know, getting some attention. And I think picking that studio because they would be familiar with the kind of music that, you know, that we were playing. And so Jack booked it because Kurt called and said that I was playing drums. And so he's like, oh, well, that sounds really cool. And so we went and recorded those songs. And Jack's a really good engineer. And it was like done, just bam, bam, we're out the door. Went and played a gig that night.
Literally, so, you did the demo in the day, and then that night you went and played a show. Amazing.
Yeah, we did.
Was that your only one time playing live with them? And then was that around the time
it was all done really quickly.
You shipped out to San Francisco? Was that around that time?
That would have been right before I left for San Francisco. But then I played with them again after. It was after Bleach had been out, and they had fired Chad, and then immediately after that had got offered a tour with Sonic Youth. So I ended up filling in for that tour.
Oh, wow.
I think that might have been all I did.
Yeah. Did you see on that tour the momentum around them growing, or was that still before the big?
They were definitely getting courted by major labels at that point, you know. And Sonic Youth, too, I think was, they were a big part of them going with DGC, because, you know, at the time, Sonic Youth had that record Goo,
yeah,
that just come out, and they, you know, they were starting to do pretty good. You know, they were selling like what we consider to be punk rock platinum, you know, like sold like 100,000 records at that point, which we were just like, wow, that's really, you know, that was like big time.
That's like as big as it gets when you're doing it at that level. Yeah.
You know, talking with those guys, thinking like, totally, you know, I mean, we're playing pretty big like theaters with those guys. So just the West Coast. But, you know, yeah, I remember just thinking like, you know, this is a really good timing. If people are interested in this kind of music, you know, you guys might even sell a couple hundred thousand. Yeah. Ended up selling quite a few million.
Yeah. What's your take on fame, Dale? Do you think fame spoils and ruins creativity and personality and happiness? And
I suppose it can. Yeah, I mean, obviously seeing what happened with those guys, you know, so like I wouldn't want that to happen. You know, I think that they expected that they would do pretty good, but then to all of a sudden just to be like, you know, on MTV 24 hours a day, I'm sure it was pretty weird, you know. And I don't know. I mean, you know, well, what can I say? It all ended badly, and all seemed to become sort of a cliche, you know, everything about what was happening with those guys. You know?
Yeah.
I'm glad I wasn't in that situation, you know, though we were really close to it. You know, I feel badly for Chris and Dave, you know, for what happened, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, so many of those other bands from that area, there's so many casualties, so many people didn't make it out. And when you left, did you have a sense of relief that you were leaving a certain element behind? As in, because wasn't Seattle pretty awash with heroin and hardcore drugs at that time? or was that nationwide? Was San Francisco the same?
Oh, I'm sure you could find that. Oh, San Francisco had just as much, I'm sure. You know, any port town is going to have a ton of that stuff. But yeah, I mean, Seattle definitely became pretty dark and whatever. So, and that was never a scene I knew, you know. So I always stayed away from that stuff. So thankfully, you know, I might end up being right there with them, you know. That wouldn't be good.
No. How was your major label experience? You did the three records with Atlantic, all great albums. I think a lot of the time when bands like you guys do sign with the major, concessions are made. They perhaps lose certain elements that make the band special in the first place. Perhaps the spirit is diluted, but you guys definitely didn't succumb to that. Those three records stand up today. But was it a positive experience being inside that machine, or how was it for you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I mean, they didn't, you know, they told us that bands will come to them and tell them, what do we need to do to be big? What do we got to do? What are we gonna, how do we sell it out here? You know, and
we're willing, you know, and able, yeah.
exactly. You know, so the bands want to do that. They want to be a big star. They want to sell millions of records and have all that, you know, big giant cocaine parties and whatnot, you know.
Again, cliche.
Right. But, you know, we got signed pretty much because, well, I mean, certainly because of the Nirvana guys is why there was any interest in us, you know, or you know, Seattle, what was happening in, to begin with. But with Atlantic, I mean, they were completely realistic about everything, you know. They're like, you know, we know you guys aren't going to change, you know. and you already are established. You know, you've already been making this work. You know, this isn't your first record. You know, we'll give you so much money and let you do whatever you want. You know, we also, by having you guys, it's going to make us look good. You know, if you guys are with us, fans will want to sign. You know?
Right. Yeah. So then they can get three more Nirvanas.
They pretty much did everything. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, you know, they don't know. They have, I don't think they have any idea of what's going to sell, you know? I mean, Atlantic had Hootie the Blowfish, Kid Rock, and the Melvins, you know? It's like, wow. You know? But we're on the same label as Aretha Franklin and Led Zeppelin, so we thought that was cool. You know? But yeah, I mean, they pretty much let us do what we wanted to. We didn't think that we would get three records out of it, because every record, the money would go up. We outlasted pretty much everybody that was there when we signed, as far as like the management, you know, like our A&R guy was gone. The vice president was gone. Hardly anybody was there anymore. So by the time we did our third record, Stag, people were just kind of like, well, what, we don't know what this is, you know? So, but, you know, we were always realistic about the fact that it's weird that we're doing this to begin with. We know this is an odd thing. Once this doesn't work out, we'll just go back to doing what we were doing before, you know, because we're already making it kind of work.
I love that. So few bands have that foresight, don't they? They just think, I need to get signed, become successful, and then that's it. Then I made it. Whereas I think you guys have always just felt, you know, if we just keep doing what we do, you're just a solid, you know, long game, artistic, interesting band, aren't you? Let's just keep putting
so
out
many
quality records, and that will last for, you know, as long as we can play.
Right. Well, so many bands too would get to that point, or they get on a major label, it wouldn't work out, they'd get dropped, and then they would just go, well, that's it, you know, I quit,
it's over,
or whatever.
Yeah.
It would just ruin them, you know. So I guess, yeah, we were just, we always try to keep our heads about that and just know, like, you know, we already weren't working day jobs, and we're already kind of making it work. You know, if we're just smart, we can go back, you know, well, we should be able to do this. You know? So it's worked out so far.
And what it continues to do, and every couple of years you guys put out always something unpredictably great. And I always await a new Melvins release with anticipation, and it's never what you'd expect. It's never like, oh yeah, of course they were going to do this next. And I think people love that, because there's so few bands nowadays that are spontaneous and unpredictable. And do you know what I mean? There's so much of that greatness of what was alternative culture to begin with. Obviously, alternative got co-opted by the mainstream, and then it's no longer alternative. It's just bland and, you know, monotonous.
Right.
But that school of creativity and DIY thinking, you guys have maintained that all along. And it's just about making interesting music, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of simple when you boil it down.
Yeah, make it interesting. Make it, I guess we never wanted to be like a regular band, whatever that is, you know. Stands out more if you're weird, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not hard. I mean, it's not hard for us to do that. You know?
Just by being yourselves, you're different. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How did you first meet Adam Jones? What's the friendship and history there?
We first met him playing a show with Tool. We were playing, I can't remember who we were playing with. I almost seems like it was like somebody like Guar or somebody like that at the Palladium in Los Angeles.
Amazing.
He later claimed that I was standoffish and not nice to him, which I was kind of like, you sure that was me? Maybe something was going on. That doesn't sound like I would be mean to somebody. Not, you know, who knows, you know? But anyway, you know, since then, yeah, we've done a lot of touring with those guys. And then also some recording and playing here and there too. I haven't seen him in a long time. Miss him, you know?
Yeah, he's been on a bunch of your records over the years. And was it Tool that helped you guys sort of piggyback onto the Ozfest in 98?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. Those guys kind of insisted that we play. they wanted to pick one band to take with them on the tour. And I think Ozfest really wanted them. I mean, they were kind of the headliner. So they're like, okay. And so we got to go. And they were super nice about, I mean, they took us on their bus, even, well, their crew bus. But, you know, still, they're like, travel with us. We'll carry all your gear as well. And, you know, come on the whole thing. It'll be fun. And so that's what we did. And it was, we got to see Motorhead every day too. And that was pretty cool.
I just spoke to Phil Campbell the other day. Love Motorhead.
Oh, right on. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, it was fun watching those guys play every day.
How was that year? Because you got Motorhead, you got Tool, you got Melvins, you've got then all the new metal, like Coal Chamber, Limp Bizkit stuff. It was a pretty broad church of heavy sounds. Was everybody into all of it, or what was the deal? Was there like a bit of a noticeable divide and disconnect? What was your experience of playing in the crowd?
Well, I suppose that we were probably the odd man. We were the oddballs for sure. You know, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was weird. You know, we found out that a lot of the bands that were on the second stage where we were actually weren't getting paid, you know?
Well, they bought their way on.
It was later that they had to buy their way on, but this one was come and play for free, you know?
For the exposure.
Right. And I suppose it worked because like on our stage, there was System of a Down, Incubus, which both went on to be really huge bands. So
gigantic bands,
yeah. And I think that, you know, the powers to be behind Ozfest felt like, oh, well, that's part of our doing. So, you know, we should be charging bands to get on the bill. So, you know, and like I said, we were there because of Tool. You know, I like Ozzy, I like Sabbath and all that stuff. But you know, he's not running the show.
No.
We all know that.
Did you see that was the year, right, that Limp Bizkit did the toilet stuff? Was that when that was happening?
Yeah.
Did you witness that? What was your take on that?
I don't know. Silly. They'd put Britney Spears in the toilet and flush her down and stuff like that. Yeah. So I don't know. You know, we kind of thought it was kind of goofy frat boy type of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I miss the 90s so much, even the more ridiculous end of it. It was every band was different back then. You know, even the bands that fell into the sort of, if you want to call it, new metal subgenre, at least they were all different as well. You know, System of a Down didn't really sound too much like Korn. And, you know, and obviously then you had bands like Rage Against the Machine, who were like genuinely great coming out of that scene as well. A dude I'd love to talk to you about is, I guess, your label boss to this day, right? Are you still on Mike's label now, the Melvins?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, mate, so you first signed after Atlantic, right? That's when you joined the label for the trilogy.
Yes. Yep, that's correct. You know, that's right. Also when Phantomos formed.
Right.
And they were looking for a record deal and couldn't find one. For whatever reason, a supergroup of Mike Patton, Dave Lombardo, Buzz Osborne, and Trevor Dunn was questioned. I don't know why somebody dropped the ball there, but because of that, they're just like, let's just start our own label. And we were looking for a label. We were going to do the same thing, start our own thing. And we're like, well, you know what? What if you guys start it, we're down. Let's, you know, we'd be on your label. And so we were kind of the flagship for the whole thing, us and Fantomas.
And you've done every album since with that label?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's been some weird kind of one-off things like Amphetamine Reptile and things like that, but every pretty much official releases, yeah, you know. Oh, and our first thing too is like, okay, well, we want to put out 3 records at once, basically. Yeah. You know, and they're like, okay. So like, all right, we know this is gonna work.
Amazing. He seems like a really good dude, Mike does. Again, someone who's a very enigmatic figure that I think people like to
what's his deal,
but he must just be a fucking regular dude. That's, man, he's smart enough to know that the enigma is probably better than, you know,
right.
revealing the truth. And then you get a quieter life, don't you?
He's a good dude. Yeah,
what a talent as well. What a supreme talent.
Yeah, and we've really had a great long working relationship with Ipecac.
And haven't you played on a bunch of the Peep and Tom stuff with him as well? You've drummed with him quite a bit, right?
Yeah. In fact, I know there's a whole shitload of stuff I recorded that I don't know if and when it'll ever come out.
But it's there.
You know? when he was doing the Peeping Tom stuff, I easily recorded 30 songs, you know? And I think, I mean, there's not that many on that Peeping Tom record, so. I don't know. Yeah, that's his thing, though. So we'll see.
Do you and Buzz write like regularly together? How does the creative partnership between you two function?
Most of the time, he just has stuff and he'll come in with stuff, you know, kind of. I think he's constantly playing and writing and just has, you know, a huge catalog of riffs on tape or whatever. There's never a shortage of songs to work on, that's for sure. You know, even this new, the Working With God record, all of a sudden we just had all these songs, you know. I co-wrote one.
Which one?
I was saying earlier, Brian the Horse Face Goon.
Great track.
I did the music, he did the words. Yeah,
great track.
Yeah.
That's probably my second favorite song on the whole record. My favorite one is The Great Good Place. I love that.
Yeah, that's mine too.
Is it? Yeah, amazing track. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Yeah. I didn't write that one, but that's my favorite song.
Well, the Horse Face Goon is also a damn good one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's a fun record, man. And it's just so refreshing to have a band like the Melvins out there after all these years and all these releases still doing it. I've got a list here, Dale, if you're interested in this. I've got a list of Buzz's top 10 Melvins records. Would you like to hear what they are out of interest?
Should I guess?
Yeah, go on. Let's do that.
Okay, Bullhead.
Bullhead is one of them. Yep.
Eggnog.
Eggnog is another.
Prick.
Let me double check on Prick. No Prick. So two out of
really?
Three.
Wow. No. Colossus of Destiny.
Colossus of Destiny. No. Not in there.
Wow.
No, sorry, it is. Colossus is. Colossus is in there.
Okay.
3 out of 4.
Okay. So, okay. Let me think. Hostile Ambient Takeover?
No. 4 out of 6.
Wow, okay, I'm losing. go ahead, tell me.
Okay, go so ahead, we have Pigs of the Roman Empire is on there.
Oh, of course. I was going to say that next.
Hold It In is on there. Your Butthole Surface collaboration.
Very good.
Nude with Boots.
Yeah.
Is on there. Freak Puke is on there with Trevor Dunn. Stoner Witch.
Uh-huh.
Bass is Loaded. And that's it. That's the 10.
Yeah.
Any surprises in there for you that you thought you wouldn't have put down in his top 10?
Oh, I'm not sure. Probably not.
What about you?
I thought Prick would be in there for sure.
Are there any omissions from that would be in your top 10 or top 5?
Oh, maybe Senile Animal would be in there for sure. I thought that was a good one, and you know, it's like completely different. Especially at that point with our band, and you know how things, us reinventing ourselves, I guess, having you know two drummers and then also having Jared in the band. I don't know. I always said Stag. I always felt like that was the one where it really hit, but yeah. I'm not sure how I feel anymore. You know.
I was reading an interview with Buzz. He said he thought that that was his favorite, and that was the best of the major trilogy.
Stag.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I really thought too. Like, I thought they were gonna love it. You know, I was like, so I'm like, oh, there's songs in here that I think, you know, I mean, probably as commercial sounding as we'll ever get. You know. But they just were confused by it, you know. Like I said, that's
the change in personnel.
Yeah, and just not really knowing like what it was, you know. Like, I mean, is it you know, like grunge is kind of now past. It's not like heavy metal. It's you know, they just didn't know.
Do you and Buzz socialize outside of music? Because you've obviously been playing together for so long now. Are you bros? Are you very, very tight?
Yeah, we hang out. I just went out. He just got a new place in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm going to check it out. And we'll do other stuff outside of the band. Yeah. Golf. Golf's a big one. Golf's a big one for everybody right now because that's all you can do outside here.
Yeah, it's easy to distance when tennis and golf are like the two sports you can play and distance fairly easily, can't you?
Yep, that's the two that you're officially allowed to do. So it's funny because, like, you know, I mean, we've been golfing for a while, but now since everybody's home, like, you can't get on the golf course. It's crazy.
Yeah. What else is going on? So the solo record's out. Let's talk about that because I love the album Rat-a-tat-tat. Your second one, the first one as well. People should definitely check out. What's the fickle finger of what?
Fate. Fickle finger of fate.
Fickle finger of fate. That was what, 2018, a few years ago.
Or 17. Yeah, 18. I can't remember.
Two incredible records. Do you write and play? Do you write and play everything? How does it work?
I write everything except, well, there's a couple co-written songs. On the new record, there's a song co-written with Toshi Kasai, who's Melvin's longtime engineer. He also plays in my live band, Dale Crover Band, and engineered the record, had quite a bit to do with it, played a lot of the keyboards. Steve McDonald played pretty much all the bass on the record.
And you're in Red Cross as well now.
Handing it over to him and having him do. And I'm, it's all incestuous. So I made that first record, Fickle Finger of Fate. And after it came out, I was like, you know, it'd be really fun to play this stuff live. I should try to put a band together. And so I did. And Steve offered to play. And Toshi and I have played together before. So I knew he'd do it. And then I got this girl I know plays drums. She was looking for a gig and I thought she'd be perfect. Her name's Mindy Jorgensen. She plays a little bit on the new record, but I do the majority of the drumming, but she's on there and she plays other instruments as well. So, our plan was going to be to, hopefully tour, you know, but, didn't happen, you know, but, what we did do recently is, I don't know if you caught the Melvin's TV special, Valentine's Day special.
Yeah, I like the way you guys are tackling that because I've been chatting to a few bands in the UK about creative ideas that I've had to collaborate because I don't think you can just do four guys or five guys or whatever on a stage playing to, you know, an empty room. It needs to be like a TV show. There needs to be a theme or a format or a concept that you can adapt over time and repeat. And, you know, because if you just do one show, that's kind of it then, isn't it? You can't then go, oh, we're now going to play again the sort of same thing. So I love that you have taken that approach to it where there's, you know, like interview elements and, yeah, it's very cool. Very Melvins as well.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's kind of a, you know, an experiment for us to see how this works, see if it'll work. But yeah, we realized that, you know, once you do one, you can't really do another. And that's when we're like, well, let's do 5 songs and we'll do it cheap, $5 to see if, you know, if people will go for that. And make it like we're big, I'm a big fan of Musikladen, the German TV show. The earlier version was called Live at the Beat Club. You probably know it. It's the one where Sabbath is on there and they're playing Paranoid and they're playing Orange Amps and they got the weird graphics behind them. They probably didn't normally play Orange Amps. Those were the studio's backlines. But now, because of that video, every stoner rock band in the world plays Orange Amps, you know? All thanks to Musikladen. So we wanted it to be like that kind of thing live, but then make it really crazy looking with the green screen stuff. And then, yeah, do some interviews, do some goofy stuff. People really like dumb.
Yeah.
You know, I've noticed like whenever we'll post like a picture on Instagram or whatever, and good thing we have a stupid sense of humor, because it just seems like the dumber something is, the more people just love it, you know? So the interview stuff's kind of like that. And you know, us filming goofy stuff or whatever as well, you know?
Well, Buzz is one of my favorite people to follow on Instagram because he's a great photographer. He's got a cool eye.
Yeah.
And he takes really, I love the pictures. He's always posting Dale Crover shots. And he's just got a cool... Yeah, eye, and also that humor comes across, and I think it obviously comes across in the music. It's there on the new record, so it's still there after all these years, and it's still enjoyable. I love that side of the Melvins, because it just shows you don't take yourself too seriously, because, you know, you obviously are sort of revered as this, you know, very underground kind of cult cool band, and some bands who fall into that category can, I think, get a little bit too cool for school and, you know, take themselves a bit seriously. Whereas you guys have always had a very self-deprecating, humble kind of, you know, this is a goof to us. Yeah, we take music seriously, but we're here to have a good time too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the band is called the Melvins.
Yeah.
Says it right there.
What's the story with that? Wasn't it some teacher or something, or some like local community figure?
It was Buzz used to work at a grocery store, and he was one of the older employees that worked there. He wasn't really the boss, but, you know, he was the older guy that would always be like, you guys quit goofing off, type of guy.
Yeah. So,
and his real name was Melvin, but he went by Pete. And his son worked there. And they said whenever his son got pissed off at him, he would go, okay, Melvin. And so... When they're trying to think up band names, one of their fellow employees was like, "You should call it the Melvins." They laughed about it, and then of course, you know, and that's kind of been the way things have been ever since. You know?
It's perfect.
Come up with some idea where you're just like, "Oh yeah, that's really funny." You know, "Oh, we could do that." You know, "Hey, how about we play every state in the country and Washington D.C. 51 shows in 51 days." We could do that. Ha, right? Yeah, ha, ha, ha. Oh, and then it happens. Yeah. So we're really good at making goofy ideas come true.
Let me ask you this as the final question, Dale. Is any idea too ridiculous or stupid for the Melvins? Has anything ever been presented to the band, put on the table, and someone's gone, nope, no way?
So far, no. no, I don't think there's, you know, I can't think of anything where it'd be like, no, I mean, no, we're pretty much game for anything.
That's why we love the Melvins.
Yeah, right on. Thanks.
Dude, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your stories, and thank you so much for your music.
Again, my apologies for being tardy.
Not at all. Not at all. It was well worth the wait, my friend. It was well worth the wait.
Excellent. Thank you. Bye-bye.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.